The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 17th of September, 2021, on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Coming up on today's program.
Can I ask my right honourable friend, what are the implications of this pact for the stance that would be taken by the United Kingdom for its response should China attempt to invade Taiwan?
The UK, the US and Australia face a barrage of criticism over their new defence pact. We'll ask what it means for international security. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will also tell us why Brazil's president is struggling in the polls. Plus, an update ahead of Canada's election on Monday. And finally, we celebrate the return of Broadway. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Daniel Bage. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte will reportedly offer his UK counterpart Boris Johnson a defence and security cooperation deal with the EU when the leaders meet in Downing Street later today. It follows yesterday's announcement that the UK, the United States and Australia had agreed their own defence pact, called AUKUS. The deal has angered many EU states, with France calling Australia's decision to scrap a huge submarine deal in favor of a nuclear-powered subs deal with the US a stab in the back. Let's get the latest now from Paul Rogers, International Security Advisor at Open Democracy. Paul, some very harsh words from Paris today. Tell us what happened here first on the Australian deal and why the French are feeling blindsided by it.
Well, with the Australian deal, the Australians essentially decided to replace their existing Collins-class submarines, which had come to the end of their useful life, with nuclear-powered submarines rather than diesel-powered submarines. The previous decision was to go in with France, which has quite a good record of producing diesel-powered submarines. It can actually produce nuclear-powered submarines for itself. I don't think it's ever exported them or considered it. But anyway, the Australians decided they needed nuclear-powered submarines, where it had this deal with the French for the diesel-powered ones. And they basically ditched that and gone in with the United States, with Britain as well, although the suspicion is that as far as the building of the new submarines are concerned, which will be done at an Australian yard in Adelaide, that will be done under American supervision, with the British relatively small. This is partly because Britain is producing its own new class of astute hunter-killer submarines, as well as its ballistic missile submarines, and in both cases it has pretty serious problems with developing the reactors. Rolls-Royce is really having a great difficulty in getting things right there. So in other words, the American ones are more reliable. So that's the basis of it. The French obviously are pretty furious at this, because what was a pretty big contract with a lot of money in it was basically ditched in favour of an Anglo-American agreement. So that's the background to this. Beyond that, of course, you have all the issues in the EU and the whole question of how one handles a rapidly growing China, which does have increasing military capabilities.
Well, on that point, Paul, the strategy here is said to be encountering China, but China calling this Cold War mentality, and it seems they may even be angered further with this new agreement. Tell us about that.
The reaction from China has been very strong. In some ways, you can look at this, there are always two ways of looking at something, which sort of cover a wide range, but essentially, the view from basically from the United States and from Britain and France and Australia is that China does represent a threat because of its growing military abilities, and therefore that has to be countered. And the Australians going for much longer range nuclear-powered hunter killers, which can deliver cruise missiles, let it be said, if need be. So they do have a land attack capability. That actually sort of provides an extra strength to the efforts to contain China. The other view would be this is just another example of an arms race developing, which could be very dangerous. And the main people who will benefit will be the different military-industrial complexes in Australia, of course, in Britain and the United States, and in China. And of course, as far as the complexes are concerned, these very strong lobbies in many ways, military and the rest, and defense industrial companies, they basically need a new enemy. The problem is that for the United States and Britain, the last 20 years have been pretty disastrous with four failed wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, the second war in Iraq against ISIS, and of course Libya. And what they really want is essentially for their own success, if you like, in what is a very competitive market, they need new enemies. Now, that in many ways is being cynical, but many people say you've got to factor that in if you're going to understand what is going on.
I want to bring in Politico's Suzanne Lynch, who is on the line now from Brussels. Suzanne, we talked off the top about the possibility or reality, I guess, today in the EU moving a little bit closer to Britain in their alliance. But there are some angry leaders today across the European Union. What's the reaction been to this AUKUS deal from Brussels?
Yeah, there certainly is. I mean, France obviously is extremely annoyed and made no secret of its feelings, both towards the Australians and towards America. The French ambassador, the French embassy in Washington cancelled a gala dinner that had been scheduled for tonight. Now, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, tried to kind of calm tempers yesterday, saying that it remained a very important partner. Blinken, of course, was educated in Paris, saw himself as very much, and he was seen as a very much a Francophile. So, but I think it's a bit little bit too late in terms of the French. They are considering all options when it comes to this contract that they signed with Australia, and they're saying that this contract was signed and they're looking into that.
Suzanne, you were previously in Washington. You know, Britain has long been seen as sort of a bridge between the U.S. and Europe, but this creates a bit of an awkward situation now for what are longstanding allies.
Yeah, I mean, France and is a member of NATO. France is a very important military power, and that's why they feel so annoyed that they weren't told. We're trying to still get some of the details on that, but the Americans are saying that it wasn't their place to tell France, that really it was Australia who had entered the contract with France about the submarines, that it was their job to tell them. But France is complaining that Washington actually briefed reporters before their own embassy and before their own officials heard. So that is quite a serious accusation. In terms of the EU broadly, of course, France is not the EU. I mean, it's its own country. At the same time, it's a very important country in the EU, and it is going to be pushing for a discussion of this at EU level, perhaps in the next Foreign Affairs Ministers meeting next month. We've also got the UN General Assembly coming up next week. There'll be quite a few European leaders at that meeting, coming face to face with people like Joe Biden, other global leaders. So that will be interesting to see how this whole controversy will feed into the discussions there.
Absolutely. Paul, you mentioned a little bit earlier strained relationships dating back to the beginning of the Iraq War, obviously Afghanistan. You would think this is a time that the Biden administration would be looking closely to its allies with the situation in Afghanistan, the rise of China. France and the U.S. are, of course, allies and have been since the 18th century. That's symbolized, of course, still by the Statue of Liberty. But this seems to be a huge misstep by the Biden administration.
Well, certainly that's the view from the EU, that it is a misstep. It is unusual, I think, to have this degree of an issue developing. I think one has to appreciate, though, that in a sense, the Australians, with a pretty hawkish government, really do want to sort of extend their military capabilities. They're putting a lot of money into naval forces. They do have some very advanced strike aircraft as well. And I think the Australians see themselves as a sort of the significant regional power after China. Obviously, Japan has huge resources, and other countries, including Taiwan, do as well. But Australia sees itself as a major player. It is not, incidentally, a view shared by Ardern in New Zealand, and the reaction in New Zealand has been pretty antagonistic to this deal. And it has been made clear at a very early stage that nuclear-powered submarines will not easily be welcome in New Zealand ports. So it's not all sort of hunky-dory in that sense. But the reality is Australia wants to remind the world that it exists, that it's major, and this is one way of doing it. As far as the British are concerned, well, you know, Harold Wilson in 1966 took the view that Britain should withdraw from East of Suez. Now, obviously, Boris Johnson, with his huge desire to talk about global Britain, because it still goes pretty well at home, has really gone beyond that. We have already a base in the Middle East, in fact, two. There's one in Bahrain, the other, the big new one at Duqm in Oman. We have facilities in Singapore. We have the aircraft carrier. Basically just leaving Japan at present. So Britain is trying to express itself as a world power on what are frankly tiny resources. And any sort of senior naval person you talk to will confirm that if we're going to have a carrier strike group a long way from Britain, we cannot do it without the United States Navy. That's the reality. But that doesn't express itself at home. And Johnson is playing this for all his get. You know, this is part of global Britain. We're a very big power. But at a smaller level, that's also true of Australia. The real crunch, I think, is the different attitudes to China. And the EU, particularly with France, basically reckon you've got to deal directly with China and not go for confrontation. Remember, within the EU also, you have, what, four neutral countries, Ireland, Sweden, Finland and Austria. So there isn't going to be a sort of a united troop front in the Far East anytime soon. So the whole situation is really very complicated, and it's coming to a head and causing a lot of concern, I would suspect, in Brussels.
Well, one we will continue to watch. Paul and Suzanne, thank you so much. That is Open Democracy's Paul Rogers and Suzanne Lynch from Politico in Brussels. Now here's Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Daniel. Candidates hoping to become Japan's next prime minister have officially started their campaigns. The leadership race for the ruling Liberal Democratic Party took an unexpected turn 2 weeks ago, when Yoshihide Suga said he would step down after only 1 year as prime minister. Google and Apple have removed Alexei Navalny's voting app from their stores ahead of this weekend's parliamentary elections in Russia. Allies of Navalny, who is President Vladimir Putin's fiercest domestic opponent, plan to use the mobile app to organize a tactical voting campaign. Three Chinese astronauts have returned to Earth after completing the country's longest crewed space mission. The men spent 90 days on China's space station, and analysts say the mission is a demonstration of China's growing confidence and capability in space. And Copenhagen's 3 days of design kicked off yesterday, with exhibitions and events held across various design venues in the capital. You can find out more about why Danish products are continuing to grow in popularity overseas by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Daniel.
Thank you very much, Emma. We turn our attention to Brazil now, where the popularity of President Jair Bolsonaro has hit the lowest point of his time in office. The far-right leader has seen his poll numbers sink due to his handling of the world's second deadliest coronavirus outbreak, rising inflation and stubborn unemployment. Let's get the latest now from Monocle's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, tell us about the numbers and how bad they are for Bolsonaro.
They are really bad, Daniel, almost stable in a way as well, because it's been declining in the last kind of weeks and months. Basically, 53% of all Brazilians disapprove of his government. And 22% approve. There's still a large section in between that doesn't really approve or disapprove. They have like no major opinions on it. And it's interesting how it's changing, because remember how surprising it is that in the peak of the pandemic, with so many deaths in Brazil, Bolsonaro popularity managed to actually rise in a way. Mm. And the reason for that, that because his government gave financial help, especially among the poorest. But now it's not the case. Our economy is not as good as people were predicting. And things are changing a little bit. The poorest are definitely leaving Bolsonaro, and he's getting back the people that are almost putting in power, which is slightly richer, older, and male from the south as well.
Well, that's really interesting. How important is that support for Bolsonaro, the support that he continues to have?
Well, on the 7th of September, our Independence Day, I mean, there was massive protests in the streets pro-Bolsonaro, in fact. To be honest, they're not as big as people were predicting. But what we're seeing that those people in the streets, they are the radical Bolsonaristas, you know, the people that are very much in touch with Bolsonaro. And you can see on the streets, this was very much cities from the south. You can see an older crowd as well. But again, if you only have that type of people, you're not going to win an election. And I'm sure Bolsonaro plans to win the election next year as well. So I wonder if there will be some populist measures as well to get the vote from the poorest as well, if there will be any more financial help. I mean, which is quite difficult otherwise because he can bankrupt the state. So it is a very complicated and delicate situation for Bolsonaro at the moment.
The other thing at play here is, of course, the return of Lula. Tell us about how that plays in ahead of next year's elections.
I mean, he's still shoo-in to become a president, but, you know, things can change. There's still a year to go for the elections next year. And interestingly enough, Daniel, just a few minutes ago, Folha de São Paulo released another poll for the presidency next year. If there will be a battle between Bolsonaro and Lula in the second round, Lula would get 56% and Bolsonaro 31%. The interesting thing here as well, there's a lot of kind of, you know, may I say, centrist in Brazil. They're saying, where is the third way? Other candidates. Listen, they might still come and we can have surprises in the middle of the way, but it is hard in a continental country like Brazil to have a new name that will leave this kind of battle between those two kind of different characters and very strong characters, both Lula and Bolsonaro. I mean, there's still a year, as I said, but I think it would be very hard to get a new name in.
Fernando, thank you for this update. That is Monocle senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Bache. It's time now for the final installment of our Canadian election series. All this week, Monocle's Toronto bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, has been profiling Canada's main political leaders ahead of Monday's snap vote. Today, we turn our attention to Maxime Bernier, the leader of the People's Party of Canada.
Let Max speak! Let Max speak!
A crowd of protesters gathered outside the Canadian Museum of History last Thursday evening before the final televised leaders' debate ahead of Election Day this coming Monday. Their chant, Let Max Speak.
Let Max speak!
Max is Maxime Bernier, the former Member of Parliament who established the People's Party of Canada in 2018 after he lost his bid to lead his former party, the Conservative Party of Canada. Given that the People's Party had failed to poll at least 5% of public support ahead of this year's election debates, Bernier was denied a spot on the debate stage, to the anger of his supporters.
You can't divorce the People's Party from its leader, Maxime Bernier.
Gary Keller is a political commentator and a former senior member of the last Conservative government under then Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
Now, Maxime Bernier was a former leadership candidate for the Conservative Party. Maxime Bernier was very much a leader who was all about himself, quite frankly, and the fact that he didn't win the leadership of the Conservative Party. He increasingly was taking positions that were contrary to Conservative Party policy and then challenged the former leadership. And frankly, the Maxime Bernier, who is the leader of the People's Party, is not the same Maxime Bernier who was a Conservative cabinet minister.
what Keller means by that is that Bernier's views have swung further to the right since he set up his party, and he's been accused of pandering to an underbelly of political viewpoints. In 2019, a candidate for the party was expelled for apparently having asked Bernier to denounce white supremacist language within the party's ranks. And earlier this year, Bernier himself was accused of using a racist slur against Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the NDP, who is the first Sikh person to lead a national party here in Canada. Bernier has denied the claim. In terms of his party's messaging, it's the coronavirus pandemic, particularly lockdowns and nationwide vaccination programs, that has hardened Bernier's rhetoric and perhaps, in the eyes of a minority of voters, heightened his appeal.
I'm doing that as the leader of the People's Party of Canada, the only political party at the federal level that is fighting against these lockdowns. And the reason of my trip is to speak about that and giving the other side of the story to Canadians.
The People's Party's platform in this election reflects that entrenching of right-wing sentiment. There's a vow to protect personal freedoms and the right to freedom of speech. There's a promise to curb inward immigration and to slow the number of refugees who are resettled in Canada, which has been a flagship part of Justin Trudeau's premiership so far. There's scepticism of climate change. And above all, there's opposition to COVID-19 health measures. Bernier himself laid down his own gauntlet on that issue in June when he got himself arrested.
A federal party leader and vocal lockdown opponent has been arrested in rural Manitoba. RCMP took Maxime Bernier into custody for holding rallies and breaking public health orders.
So that's why I'm telling you we have the best platform for you, but not only for you, for the country. Because if we don't do these bold reforms, this country won't exist in 20 years.
There's a reason that Bernier's been compared to former US President Donald Trump. Putting Canada first has become a rhetorical theme for Bernier, a reference, of course, to the former US leader's America First lexicon. And many of the protests that have targeted Prime Minister Justin Trudeau during this campaign have been organised by supporters of the People's Party of Canada. Their trademark purple hats and placards with the white PPC acronym sewn or printed on them have been a visible and consistent presence in those angry crowds. And earlier this week, a 25-year-old local leader for the PPC was charged by police for having thrown stones at the Prime Minister during one particularly angry protest last week. The man has been expelled from the party. Gary Keller again.
Especially since the pandemic has started, the People's Party has become a home for, you know, people who are opposed to vaccination mandates, opposed to vaccinations altogether. And it really has become this catch-all of disgruntled, angry people. They're angry about a lot of things. And Mr. Bernier has only just fed those views.
A broader backdrop to Bernier's political brand in this campaign is an increasing concern of the effect that the dissemination of misinformation online is having on parts of Canadian society. This rebuttal by Justin Trudeau after one of the leaders' debates last week to a member of staff at Rebel News, which is a website that's accused of publishing inaccurate and sensationalist information online, demonstrates the strength of mainstream feeling growing against the rise of outlets like these in Canada.
Your group of individuals need to take accountability for some of the polarization that we're seeing in this country. And I think Canadians are cluing into the fact that there is a really important decision we take about the kind of country we want to see. And I salute all extraordinary, hardworking journalists that put science and facts at the heart of what they do and ask me tough questions every day. But make sure that they are educating and informing Canadians from a broad range of perspectives, which is the last thing that you guys do.
Support for the PPC in opinion polling during this campaign has grown to around 6%. That support is small and likely won't translate into any parliamentary seats on election day. But it is a rise worth noting, given that the PPC was hovering at around 3 or 4% support at the start of the campaign. The Canadian press is increasingly assessing what this might mean, both for Canada's political discourse, but also electorally for Canada's other parties, particularly the Conservatives. Away from politics, however, there's a serious question about whether the anger that's crystallised around the PPC during this election campaign is, in one way or another, here to stay.
And I believe that, you know, this party is growing and this election will be another important one for us.
For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
That is Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis wrapping up this week's Canadian election series. We'll have full coverage on Monday's vote next week across all our daily news shows. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's program, Broadway is back. For the first time since March of last year, New York's iconic theaters have reopened at full capacity, ending the longest shutdown in Broadway history. And several blockbuster musicals, including Hamilton, Wicked, and The Lion King, are raising their curtains. Joining me in the studio is theater critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolff. Matt, great to have you here.
Lovely
nice to
be
see
here.
You.
Thank you.
Broadway reopened earlier this week, but it was perhaps overshadowed by the Met Gala for many people.
Yes,
but it is.
That's real theater. That's true theater.
It has reopened. How have things been going?
Well, you know, there was a lot of anticipation. Mm. Clearly, an 18-month shutdown in New York terms might as well be 18 years.
Yeah.
New York has weathered a lot of storms in the past. Obviously, 9/11 was a huge shock to the system. But to have the sort of artistic engine of really the U.S. and live performance close-up shot for that amount of time was shocking.
Mm.
As a result, it took a long time. They didn't want to socially distance. Broadway's a commercial enterprise. You can't socially distance in a theaters. They need to make money. So I think people are really excited, relieved, a little nervous.
Yeah.
How is it going to go? We'll see.
So there are mandates in place. You need to be vaccinated. You need to have a mask and all that stuff. Do people mind? Are people happy to go back?
Well, yes. I mean, it's interesting that the tourist audience, which makes up 2/3 of your normal Broadway audience, can be from all over the country.
Yeah.
And as we know, there's a lot of partisan politics in America, people who don't want to wear masks, who have refused to be vaccinated. It's going to be very interesting to see now the New Yorkers and the people in that area are more than happy to flood back to Broadway.
Yeah.
But what are the implications long term when that tourist market, which is crucial to Broadway, is told you've got to do this and that and they don't want to?
Right.
There was a story in New York just a couple days ago about a family from Texas who beat up somebody in an Italian restaurant in New York who insisted that they wear a mask.
So you mentioned 9/11 there, mm-hmm. and obviously this week's reopening comes on the 20th anniversary. I imagine there was quite the mood in New York, and I imagine joyous as Broadway was reopening. What were the big highlights of things raising the curtain?
Well, it's been very touching just reading about it. I, of course, have been here in London, but I'm a New Yorker, and this is my home city. So it was really lovely to see Kristen Chenoweth, for example, a beloved figure on Broadway, who was the original Glinda in Wicked, appearing at the very beginning of the first reopening show of that mega musical to welcome the audience back. Lin-Manuel Miranda, of course, the powerhouse behind Hamilton, which has been, the Broadway success story of the last decade, appearing in front of his theater to the tune of New York, New York, the song telling everyone to wear a mask and get vaccinated. So it's seeing familiar faces in familiar shows. The other interesting question is what will happen when shows that the audience doesn't know as well come to town. Right now, it's like greeting old friends.
Well, speaking of new shows here in London, we might as well check in on the situation here. Back to the Future is coming.
Yeah, now, this is the stage musical, of course, the Zemeckis 1985 movie. Possibly not the first thing you might think of as a stage musical, because if you think about the film, what do you possibly think of principally? The DeLorean car.
Right.
And my colleague Alex Marshall at the New York Times read a very good piece about how they got the car onto the stage at the Adelphi Theater. Shows you where their priorities are. But interestingly, with reference to New York, barely had Back to the Future opened before, first of all, its wonderful leading man, Roger Bart, who's playing Doc, the Christopher Lloyd part on stage, had to bow out of his own opening night because of COVID. I saw him the previous day at a preview, and he was terrific. The next day, he tested positive and had to bow out. His understudy then went on. But the last two nights, they've canceled the show altogether.
Mm.
That's what Broadway is worried about. That's exactly their worry. What if you raise the curtain and then have to lower it.
Well, what is being said about that? How are they going to handle it? And do you, I mean, obviously there are expected hiccups.
I think what's being said about it in New York is that possibly Australia, which has also opened and had to shut, and some shows in London have maybe not been as vigilant as Broadway would like to be. Broadway is upping the vigilance, and they're going to hope that that will secure themselves and their audience.
Well, we remain positive. Talk to us a little bit about what else we could see as far as favorite shows and new shows coming.
Well, very movingly, and this is remarkable for me. I'm a huge fan of his work. The American composer Stephen Sondheim, who's now 91 and a half, was on Stephen Colbert's late night show the other night. 91 and a half to be on a talk show is pretty good. And looking very good, sounding even better. And he was beating the drum for a new musical that he is going to have on Broadway next season with Nathan Lane and Bernadette Peters. He's pretty good, age 91. He'll be 92 then. And a revival coming up of his wonderful show Company that was in London a couple seasons ago, where they gender flipped the leading character, who's now a woman. So that's really exciting. There's a tremendous wealth of very interesting Black American plays coming. I think Broadway has taken this opportunity to kind of reset the chart in terms of, you know, just widening the terrain, making Broadway as accessible to artists of color and audiences of color as well as they could possibly be. There are seven Black American plays opening this autumn. I think that's a record for Broadway. So that's really exciting. I think I'm going to be there over the Christmas holidays, and I have to say, I cannot wait to share the buzz. It's one thing to read about it at a remove or on a screen, but I want to be back in Times Square amidst the throngs.
Well, Matt, we'll have to have you back for another update. For now, thank you so much for being here. That is Matt Wolf, theater critic for the International New York Times. And that's it for today's edition of The Briefing, produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our researcher was Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our studio manager, Krista Blackwa. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time, 1300 in Zurich, midday here in London. I'm Daniel Bage. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.